Hello, everyone. This is Ken Hardison. We're here with Pilna, and we're waiting on Jay Abraham. Just a little bit of housekeeping while we're waiting. This will be downloaded into the members' site probably tomorrow. And if you don't know how to get into your member site, there's a member login. You can contact Jessica at pilma.org, and she will send you your
Okay, coordinate. Hello?
Hello, Jay. Yes. How you doing?
Good.
Great.
One second.
Great.
One second. So I'm going to say hello, and then I'll explain I'm late. One second. Don't go anywhere. I'm sorry, everybody. Is everybody listening all right?
Yes.
Okay, everyone, apologies. One second. Damon, say hello. I'm late because I'm with my friend Damon John from Shark Tank, and we're talking some other business, but he'll say hello for 1 minute before I take over. These are all alternatives.
Yeah, I'm Jay's secretary for the moment. You want to just tell him? Hey, guys, how you doing?
Hey, how are you doing? Well, that's an unexpected pleasure.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it.
I'm an avid fan of your show, and
amazing.
I learned a lot of things from it. Learned how to make
presentations. Where are you guys based? You're all over the place?
All over the United States and Canada.
Yeah. And you're from where?
I'm originally from Raleigh, North Carolina. Yeah, well, everybody says Texas, but I'm originally from Raleigh, North Carolina. I live in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina now.
Oh, so my girls live, Raleigh and Cary.
Yeah, that's where I grew up. Absolutely.
All right, well, Jay got me playing secretary right now. I'm just, All right, guys, have a good call. Hold on 1 second.
All right, thank you.
He'll take 5 to 7 is better. Okay, guys.
Yeah, hey, Jay.
I apologize. Are you there?
I'm here.
Ken, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
That's okay. All right, so here I am. Apologies. I had to go to a meeting downtown with Damon, and I got stuck, and we were just finishing up. Okay, I'm here. What do I have to do?
Oh, just let me introduce you, and then I'll ask you some questions.
Okay.
And you'll give me some wonderful answers.
All right.
So, welcome, everybody, to the October monthly teleseminar, and we have the great pleasure of having the infamous, famous, greatest marketer in the United States, the world over, Jay Abraham. And for those that don't know who he is, you need to find out. And you can go to, what's the website? Is abraham.com or is it Jay Abraham?
Yeah, but if you just want to bypass all the rhetoric, all the good stuff's on abraham.com, /profit resources. That's better for people.
Yeah. And he's got loads of stuff that on there for free, but he's a founder and CEO of the Abraham Group in Los Angeles, California. He spent his entire career solving problems and fixing businesses. He has significantly increased the bottom lines of over 10,000 clients in more than 400 industries and over 7,200 sub-industries worldwide. He has dealt with virtually every type of business. He has studied solving almost every type of business question, challenge, and opportunity. And this is the key to Jay, as far as I'm concerned. He has an uncanny ability to increase business income, wealth, and success. He knows how to uncover hidden assets, overlooked opportunities, and undervalued possibilities. And this has caught the attention and respect of CEOs, of best-selling authors, entrepreneurs, and marketing experts. As you can see, you have Damon. Jay plays in the big leagues, and we are very fortunate to have him with us here today. And personally, I can tell you, I probably spent over $30,000 for his materials over the years, and I had the pleasure and got him. I had to apply for it, but got selected to be in a mastermind group, and I've been in it since January of this year, from people all over the world, and it has been tremendous as far as the knowledge I've gained from it, and I feel like we've become friends, and because I share my trials and tribulations, and, you know, I don't care how successful you are, there's always some obstacle in the way, and you're always trying to figure out how to go around it or over it or under it or whatever to get up to the other side. And Jay has that uncanny ability to help you do that. And so I ask him, and he usually doesn't speak to groups as small, but I ask him if he would do it for me, and he graciously give up some of his time. And as Mark Cuban has said on the Shark Tank, time is valuable, you know, he can have the money, but you got to have the time. So I understand that, Jay, and I appreciate you being with us here today. I really do.
It's my pleasure. It's great fun. So, you know, hit me with your best shots, and let's see what I can do to help, and just tell
me,
you know, what I can do.
Yeah. Well, most of our members are they're lawyers, but I think of them as entrepreneurs. And so I know you've been all over the world. I know you're speaking over in Hong Kong and Singapore, wherever, all over the country, in China. And I know you've done seminars where you charge people $25,000. I know you charge people $50,000 for a one-day consult. So and people pay it. So what my question is, what is the biggest mistake you see businesses, entrepreneurs, lawyers, whoever, people that are in business for profit make, and how can they avoid it?
It's a big global question. So anybody who knows my work knows that there's three parts to my work. One is strategy, one's marketing, and one is ideology or philosophy. So I'm going to work backwards. The biggest thing we do for anybody we ever work with is we install what we call a strategy of preeminence. And preeminence is pretty self-explanatory, definitely to you guys or girls. It's establishing yourself as the only viable solution in the marketplace, the only trusted source they would turn to, the entity, the person, the service product that understands them better than anything else. You can't be preeminent if you don't first turn your attention external. You have to understand how they think, what it's like to be them, walk in their shoes. I'm going to give you the short course because it would take a couple hours to explain it, but there's plenty of 5 hours of stuff on my website about it, video, audio, all that stuff. But the key to being preeminent is, first of all, trying to be able to demonstrate in phrases and words that you understand what they are feeling, what they want to get away from, in verbiage they've never even been able to put their own mind into, because that shows them, that gives them clarity. When they get clarity, it gives them understanding. When they get understanding, it gets power, and the person that gives people power owns them. The key to being preeminent is telling them exactly what they need to do and why they need to do it, and not, you know, pussyfooting and trying to, you know, win their trust by being patronizing or pandering. And I'm going to give you just some short ones. It's taking them into the future and showing them what it will be like. And I'm sure in your profession you can't assure them, but you can show them good and bad. They call it the Dickens pattern, what it's like if they don't do anything, if they don't try to, you know, get their rights, and all kinds of things that are denominating a picture in their mind. The key to being preeminent really is a very simple distinction. You may love the law. You may love, you know, outwitting the competition. You may love killing people in, you know, in brilliant, intellectual intercourse. You may love mastering interrogatories and deposition. But the truth is, if you're going to be preeminent, you fall in love with a client and you live to make their life better and protect them. And there's a whole litany of things. So that's one thing. In the ideological, philosophical, it's being preeminent. In the business standpoint, most people are not strategic. I presume from your training, you got critical thinking training, but I do not know if you're very strategic. Strategic has a lot of elements. Number one element in being strategic is having a business model that keeps working harder and harder for you and keeps generating the most high quality of prospects and has the greatest conversion migration process. Being strategic is if you understand that referrals, for example, are a critical and a more viable source of cases and business than anything else you do, having at least one and preferably three, four, five, we know 93 different referral generating strategies and systems at work all the time, not just intermittently hoping that your advertising and your awards and your successes will build clients, although they will, but that's intermittent, that's episodic, that's dumb. You want to really get the strategy in place. There's lots of different options. The next thing is highest and best use theory. Highest and best use theory, anybody in commercial real estate knows what that is, but I'll give you a quick summary. If I owned an old beat-up house in the middle of a prime location in the heart of Beverly Hills next to the Rodeo Hotel, and I wanted to appraise it. They wouldn't appraise it as a two-bedroom, 800-square-foot house. They'd appraise the land if it was converted to its highest and best use. Highest and best use theory applies to lots of things. It particularly applies to marketing. It applies to the message. It applies to the process. I've been trained. I've worked years ago, just so you have a little edification. Decision Quest was a client of mine. Anybody who doesn't know it, they were, I don't know if they still are, the largest litigation consulting strategist in the field. Also, the Deming Organization, which was the father of process improvement optimization, was mine client. So was the world's largest multivariable testing organization. I tell you this quickly because there are a lot of impact points, just like there are probably impact points in a case, and each one has leverage or it can be a deterrent. You have to understand in your business, and as a business, you've got lots of parallel universes going on. So one is being strategic, not tactical, and it goes into a long explanation. Most companies I look at, most businesses I look at, I would venture to say most law firms are tactical. Finally, if you are going to be a marketer, you've got to maximize your marketing, and you maximize your marketing through a number of things. First is testing. You test all kinds of elements because I was in the lead-generating business, and lead-generating business can be the case-generating business, and people didn't – they weren't very discerning about quality, quantity, convertibility, timeline of convertibility. There's all kinds of things. Excuse that. It's my phone that I'll turn off. It's just sitting here. I'll turn it off. Excuse me 1 second. And you've got to be able to look at all those things. I don't know if I'm giving you a composite – difficult attention deficit sort of an answer, Ken, but there's a lot of elements that are the most important. But the most important, probably if you summarize them all and integrate them all, it's having a proposition and a reason why they should choose you over everyone else that is so emotionally / intellectually compelling that there's no choice, and it moves people to action. The key to everything, nothing happens until somebody acts. It's sort of a derivative of Einstein and relativity, and you've got to get people to act, and you've got to get them to act because they see you as the solution to their problem and the solver who's more capable, more effective, more empathic, whatever it is, at a level no one else is. And it's axiomatic, but that's really it. Sorry, Ken, if it's wrong.
No, that's quite, and what you said something was you got to fall in love with your client, and I've read this somewhere, I don't take credit for it, but I said where most lawyers fail or businesses is they fall in love with their business, not their clients, and that's a danger zone, or they become, and I think trial lawyers especially become, if they start becoming successful, they think they got it figured out, and they've got big egos, and I'm one, so I can say that without, because the truth is the truth. It's not a bad thing. I mean, actually, the best trial lawyers have the best egos, I think, because they're very confident. They have to go in there and convince people, and so that's a good thing, but you can't read too much of your own.
There's a very fine line, Ken, between confidence, arrogance, and hubris.
Yeah. And then the other thing you were talking about, strategic versus tactical, and I think I've tried to explain it before, but the deal is, it's like tactical is just going to run a yellow page or go do these TV commercials or whatever, saying if you're hurt, call me. But instead of figuring out what their ideal case is, but look at where all their money's coming from and saying, okay, if I know most of my money's coming from head injury cases or strategically, I sit there and think about what kind of accidents do people get in that they have head injury cases. Well, a lot of them are motorcycle accidents. They could be ever, and you can sit there and look at your database and see where they came from and then figure, okay, strategically, I want head injury cases, and I know that they come from these type of accidents. And so where can I go to before these people go before or after? What does my ideal client look like, and go ahead and market, and then figure out the tactics. I call them the spokes in the wheels, but the big wheel is the strategy, the rubber around it. But the spokes that hold it together are kind of little spider webs. Is the tactics that you go out there and use to get that ideal client That, am I right or am I wrong as far as explaining?
You are. Yeah, I mean, if you look at most people, and you're exactly right, most people do things episodically, intermittently. They don't integrate. They're short-term in the design, obviously, and everyone needs to generate cash flow, to generate cash or cases or whatever for your practice. But being strategic is that when you're strategic, you don't do anything that doesn't advance and enhance a master strategy. And the strategy is very well-defined, and it is basically maximizing whatever positioning, whatever access and assets you have, and they can be different things. I mean, I recommend every one of you write a book or get a book written and give it away and make it a really provocative book that really, and I'm not in that business. I don't want to be in that business. I can tell Ken some people in that business that do it, but.
Oh, we do it.
So I'm helping
books.
You, but not knowingly because you want to distinguish yourself. You got to have, I used to do unique selling proposition, and that was the advantage over everybody else. But I moved to preeminence because preeminence is it's quantum leaps. It's much more, it's a strata that is so much heightened and impenetrable. When you become preeminent, you own the market. And preeminence doesn't have to be the $10 million cases. You can be the preeminent $30,000 case person, the preeminent, you know, advocate of a category of business, the preeminent whatever you want. But you have to have a strategy. Like, I'll give you an example. I used to do seminars. And I would do seminars that were back, I'm 64. When I was in my 30s and 40s, we did $250 million of seminars, quite a bit for the time. I burnt out doing it. But when I did them, we would never go to the outside market. It was a waste. We did a couple times, and I'll tell you the story. We would go to Hoop, and there's a. I got to tell a story, Ken. I'm sorry, I am a poster boy for adult attention deficit. A friend of mine, a very great marketer, one time I was doing a seminar for me, and asked a question. If you could have a restaurant in your city, and you could have any single advantage, what would you want it to be? And you go around the room, and somebody say, "I want the only McDonald's. I want the only Chinese restaurant. I want the only." Restaurant at the convergence of five highways, et cetera, et cetera. He'd say, fine, you can have that. After everyone took theirs, he'd say, you know what, I want a starving crowd. A starving crowd really means how can you ethically and legally get the greatest direct access to the market you want? And surprisingly, there are a lot of ways. I know you guys have regulatory constraints. I know you have a lot of issues that are constraining and you can't do. However, there's always ethical ways to figure out who's already got the market you want and how to preemptively get access to them in some kind of a tangible or intangible compensation that is in to the correct side of decorum. I'm going back to what I used to do. We figured out who had the market. We, in the early days of investment, before everybody became an investor, the investment newsletters before the internet, they all had people who had money. They were doctors, lawyers, entrepreneurs. Tony Robbins, even though he was rah-rah, et cetera, about 5% of his market were entrepreneurs who achieved great success and thought it was going to transform their life, and they were still depressed and unhappy. And we found lots of different people like that. And we would go to them, and we never paid for advertising. We paid for results. You can't do that. But we found the most direct path, and everything we did was about five times more viable than just going to the outside market and paying for 100% of the market when maybe 3 or 4% of them were our market. Separately, our strategy was we go to these lists, and I charge $50,000 a day when I consult. I usually work on contingency like a lot of you, but a $50,000 a day fixed rate gives you a great contrast. So we would go to somebody's affinity group, and we would send endorsed by the person, a letter from that person, hard letter, offering them Jay Abraham at $50,000 a day. I would normally get a couple of people, and it would break even from the first communication. Then we go at the second one to everyone else and say, so many people were intrigued, provoked, and yet they thought, I can't afford, or why would I want to afford that? But they said, is there any other way we can work with them? And we said, yeah, Jay's willing to do, you know, economies of scale, do a group. And we ended up doing At first, we were $15,000 a piece, and we got down to small ones at $5,000 a piece where they could come to the program. And we did very well. We had thousands of thousands. Then we'd pull those names off and go back, and then we'd say, so many people wanted to do it, but their time or their budget didn't work. And then we sold what we called home study, the videos and the audios for half price. And then we'd take those off and say, so many people wanted to do it, but they just couldn't justify it. And we sold a $400 starter kit that got credit forward. We used to have all kinds of integrative approaches. I was in the business of the gold business before this current cycle, back when it first became legal. Everybody else was selling direct, and they were trying to hammer people and get a $5,000 or $10,000 sale. And we aligned with all the people that had the investors, and our approach is we wouldn't even sell you until we were confident that you were comfortable with the investment. We wouldn't let you spend more money until you got comfortable with gold. We wouldn't let you buy other things. And we went and we interviewed all these experts on all kinds of investment, including gold, but also ones that hated gold. And we gave them all this education so they were balanced, and they trusted us immensely. And one of the things, by the way, with being preeminent, I'm going back and forth, is you have an attitude. It's only a matter of time before the people you want to have as clients will become clients. So you don't wait for, and I would say, money to change hands in terms of you, for to be retained, for you to add value. You start adding so much value, and I know everyone's got websites with all kinds of stuff, and I know you'll give a free consultation, but there's ways to denominate value that are much more dimensional and much more superlative and much more desirable. And again, I'm trying not to give you a deep consultation. I apologize.
But like one example of that would be like when you're courting them or whatever, you send them educational-based marketing materials like the 11 questions you should ask to adjust, or the 58 defenses they're going to try to defeat your cases, or the 7 fatal mistakes, and just keep pumping them with these different reports and then these books that you do. Don't you? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, you do. But there's an integration. There's also another. I mean, if you can think of Kevlar, if you take a Kevlar jacket and open it up, it's a bunch of different intermittent, crisscrossed, whatever that material is, becomes impenetrable. You do like a positive Chinese water torture, and you can. I'm going to use the word hit people, which is almost a play on words given the business that you're in. But you sequentially communicate with them, unless you close them on the first communication, with a series of connections that demonstrate to them that you know better than they do what they're feeling. You show them that you feel them, you understand them. And I can give you some really cool shortcuts that are pretty cool, even though I'm not purporting to be a specialist in your field. But you don't just give them the 10 things to know, or the 10 things to do, or what will probably happen when you go to court, or what will happen if you settle and don't at least seek an attorney. You also have what's called assumptive communication. And assumptive communication communicates to them and assumes that you're talking to the people that get this. I know what it must be like when you're involved in a major accident. I know how it disrupts your life. I know how not just the pain, but the indignation. I know, and you can modify the communications to the scenarios that you know about. If you know it was an accident that was sort of, you know, not intended, it was intended, somebody was, I mean, all these different things, but you demonstrate empathic understanding and you put into words what they feel, but that nobody has ever expressed and they haven't even comprehended themselves. And I'm giving you more, not just macro stuff, I'm giving you some micro stuff that's very powerful, Ken.
Yeah, it is very, very powerful.
Ken, can you? We're doing a video with Damon, and I got to give somebody my credit card. Hold on, just 1 second. I'm apologetic,
okay.
But see, you guys get to see what real life is like. Hold on. Are you better off having you do it, or do you want to get a crew? You think about it. Don't tell me now. I'm back. Sorry.
Okay. So. And then, so how important is for your team or staff to share this vision? I mean, how do you get those people to come on board?
Let me give you, great question. So I learned preeminence. I wish I could tell you that it was my original thesis and that I gave birth to it and I'm such the proud father and it's all me, me, me. It isn't. A client of mine was in the investment field, and their company was sold for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. But what's more important, they were three times larger than their closest competitor. They were, pardon me, five times more profitable. And most importantly, they had retention, loyalty, renewal, all the factors that are denominators that get people to pay a premium, not three times, but 10, 11, 12 times, because of some foundational philosophy. And I wanted to know what it was, and I traded them a week of my time, which was about $500,000, for the privilege of interviewing their whole team with the understanding I wouldn't compete against them. And I had 1,000 pages of notes that I distilled down. And what it was is everyone, and it's an axiom. If you study The Art of War, I think it's Sun Tzu, he says, he will win whose team is animated with the same spirit. The man who gave birth to this made everyone lived it. They felt it. They all felt a part of the outcome. It didn't matter if they were secretary, producer, writer, you know, intern. They all saw that they were there to make the investor more successful, to protect the investor, or whatever the purpose of. And everyone had a unified shared vision, and the owner very methodically and very painstakingly and very heartfelt, very authentically shared all this stuff with all these people. And it was, they always lived it. It was foundational. I interviewed maybe 400 people, and every one of them shared the same vision. And it wasn't mechanical or robotic. It was instilled in their heart, and they saw that they weren't just helping an investor be better and make more money and not lose. They were helping that investor's family have a greater life, more prosperity. They were seeing all the impact. When I do my work, like with you guys and girls, I'm seeing that if I help you in this few, you know, hour or so, you'll be more effective. You'll get more clients, but you'll get more clients whose lives you can protect, whose lives you can enhance, who, no, money may not make up for the suffering, the pain, the indignation, but they have more stability, more security. You'll help their family be assured of a better life. You'll be, you know, if there's an indignation, you'll help right that. But there's so much more to being preeminent than just a vehicle for making money. And there's a concept to the strategy of preeminent. It's most people say, well, what do I have to say or do to get the deal, to get the client, to get the case? And it's not that. It's how much more value, how much more contribution do you have to make that is so clearly and definitively evident that it transcends anyone else you're competing against, so that it's impossible for the market not to choose you. That's sort of the concept.
And it's a great concept. You know, I do the deal that I put it in my newsletter every month to my past clients and present clients, is I want them to think of me as their trusted legal advisor. Even if I don't do that area of law, I'm going to find somebody that I trust. And what I've tried to develop over the years is, if you're in my herd and you got a legal problem, you call me. And if I can't help you, I'll get you somebody that can. And so then I become the trusted advisor for legal problems. And it might not be stuff that I handle, but I'm still there. And that way I can decide if I want to keep it or not. And I can also get referral fees from referring it to really good lawyers.
That makes total sense. Let me give you a very interesting, because I forgot a distinction. I'm not trying to usurp you, but I got a meager amount of time with your colleagues, so let me try to impart as much as I can. It's sort of interesting. The concept of preeminence connects to referral generation. Let me give you the mental model. So I'm going to presume, unless you're all cold-hearted, and I doubt if you're really as cold-hearted as your industry is depicted, if you're a meaningful human being, the odds are many of you have good friends, you know, great friends, and probably some or most of you have a best friend. If you have a best friend, he or she is somebody that you would talk to frequently. He or she is somebody that you would give, you know, maybe you're not your life to, but you would really give generously to help, and you really care deeply about him or her, and anyone important to him or her is important to you. And if they ask you, let's say you're an expert on stereo or an expert on computer or an expert on timeshare, not as an attorney, just as a friend, and they said, you know, Jay, I have a friend who's trying to figure out timeshare. You would help them even if it didn't pay off. You would help their friend because your friend was important to you. And that's the attitude of preeminence in generating referrals. Every client you ever talk to, you're there for them. You're there for them after the case. And you're not just there for them with your silly newsletter. I'm not demeaning newsletters. But you're there, and they want them to know that anytime anyone in their life has a problem, preferably and hopefully in your domain, but if not, they can call you and you'll put them in touch with somebody because they're important. You are their trusted advisor for life because candidly and sadly, you know that in the scope of forever, and you hope and pray it's not they, but other people in their life they care about, their family, their children, their coworkers, their workers, their church members, they're going to suffer consequences. They're going to need somebody like you, and you're always there for them, irrespective of whether or not they avail themselves of you, but you always want them to know they can refer anybody to you, at least for masterful perspective, to have a trusted conversation, and you're always there for them. And it's a really powerful distinction, and it carries to your strategy and how you communicate after. And even now you communicate with people that don't use you, because I've had lots of business from people that did not initially do business with me, and I still invested in them. I still continually communicated with them. And all the communications you make in every form, they have to have value. They have to have an impact. If they don't, they're a waste. I can go on and on and on and on and on and on.
Yeah.
But I don't want to usurp your questions.
So, you know, in some of the states, we can't use testimonials for soliciting, but we can use testimonials as what somebody contacts you. You can send it to them. So everybody can use them. I had some lawyers say, well, we can't use them, but you can use them. But I know that you think they're pretty important. So how important are testimonials and why?
Well, let me just say proof. It's like proof. It's like, I'll give you a really fun, and again, I'm in a field that where you can't. When people would call me contemplating engaging me, they would start with almost a defiant, well, I don't even know that you're viable. And I'd say, good question, great question. And I'd say, give me your address. And they'd say, why? I'd say, give me your address. And the next day by Federal Express, they'd have an 8-pound book of 2,000 testimonials. We used to run, I told you we didn't do advertising. We did one thing just to be so not just edgy, but so incomparable. I used to run 16-page, they look like supplements in the in-flights in United, in Delta, in Success Magazine. And they were only designed to break in, but they were masterful posture. And they would give 5 or 6 really great concepts right there that anybody could use or at least validate. But what was profound about them to everyone else, they had 3 full pages of testimonials, and that wasn't what was so cool. Not only did they have the testimonials, and they were diverse as can be in industry, and they had the picture, they had the daytime phone numbers because those people were so happy about me that they were fine letting people call them as long as they weren't, you know, jackasses. And credibility and proof, credibility and proof. I've been written about in Forbes. They called me, and I'm not saying this to be braggadocious. They called me, you know, one of the 5 people in the genre of executive coaches. It was a real thing. I've been written about in Success. And most of these articles didn't really bring a lot of business. However, when you send those articles, when you send your books, when you send the press, I send people, I mean, I think, again, if you go and look up Jay Abraham right now and you don't put quotes around it, it's very impressive. It's like 38 million. It's certainly not online. It may be today 22 million or 6 million, but we actually send pictures of that. We say they're not online, but you'll be hard pressed to find anything but laudatory stuff about me, and you'll see that I've influenced most of these people. All things. I use an analogy that you should all be able to relate with. You know your scales of justice. Well, I believe you want to do everything continuously to weight the decision so favorably in your behalf that it's again, using a legal word, no contest. And proof, credibility. When I was with Decision Quest, it was pretty interesting. I was with them as a consultant. I didn't work for them. But whenever they were called in to look at a potential case, they had done so much work already that we could slice and dice all that we had done by categories. In other words, we've done more cases in this venue or on this subject, or where a foreign corporation was this, or where a Southern jury was this or that. And it was true. So if you can't do actual testimony, there's always, I mean, everyone, you're in a field, I don't know if black and white even exists because it's probably subjective, and then you got decisions that are determined by judges and juries, and it can be very complicated, I'm sure. But in a world where most people are thinking black and white, like I can't legally use testimony, the question is what can you leave? It's not what can't you do, what can you do? You know,
right.
What can you do in lieu of that? And it's very exciting when you use your ingenuity in a very qualitative way. I'm sorry, I hope I'm giving you some answers.
No, I got a follow-up question. So it's fair to say, when I heard the word 2000, so you can never have too many testimonials.
No, and what we used to do, this is hilarious. I got to the point before I burnt out on the seminar business where when people would call up, sort of tentative and apprehensive, we would say, okay, tell us about your business. And we'd ask them a bunch of different calibrating questions. We'd ask them size, rural, how do you sell, market, whether, and the answer could be, I'm in rural, I'm urban, I sell by salespeople, I just get referrals, I sell a profession, business to business, whatever it was. We'd say, okay, how would you like, how many dozen or hundreds of like-minded success stories do you want in that category? You want them by urban, you want people that are in your field, you want people who are selling service, you want people that are doing, it's like, I mean, I've done all this stuff, and it's just over, it's like, no, okay, stop.
Does that answer your question? Yes, it does. So, I mean, I've read pretty much everything you've done over the years, and one of your concepts is 21 proven principles, and we don't have time today to go through all 20 of them, but if you could pick two or three of those 21 principles or one, which one's the most important? Why?
When I say this to you, please don't be offended. I'm saying this to all of you. If you study my body of work, I have 21 principles. I've got 21 PowerPoints. I've got 9 drivers of exponential growth. I've got the X factors. I've got 9 sticking points. I don't even remember them, but I do remember that there are two of them that are pretty funny. It's sort of like Winston Churchill. One is always follow up, and the next one is always follow up more. There's so many that I don't even remember them.
Yeah.
But you're welcome if you want to put them up for people. If you've got them, put them up on your website. I don't care.
Okay. And you know, and the deal is what I see lawyers do a lot, and I go out and do some consulting, not nearly as much as you've done in your life, but what I find is that's one of the things, and we've really been trying to teach her, is on the back end. They're so concerned about getting cases in or getting people to ring the phone or that they forget about the ones that I call them the fence sitters, and they don't do enough follow-up, and it's studies have shown it takes 6-7 times of touching people that are indecisive to get them where they really make a decision.
I'll talk a minute, and I'm not trying to usurp you, but I have to be off at the top of the hour, and I'm going to be respectful to you. One of the ironies that I have seen in your field, and it is very ironic because most of you are profoundly gifted critical thinkers, but it's harnessed and challenged almost exclusively into your professional, not output, but your professional expression. But you don't use, I mean, people think for some deluded reason that marketing and selling, no matter what you're selling, tangible, intangible, regulated or not regulated, is some kind of art. It's a science, and there's all these critical factors, these impact points, these connections, these progressive processes and sub-processes. If you understand them, you own the world, but you have to understand what they all are, and you have to be as judicious and mindful of those impact points in a critical thinking way as you would, you know, what something means in a deposition or an interrogatory or a statement where on the stand somebody flinches. I mean, all that stuff is translatable to marketing.
Yeah, I agree absolutely. I mean, you know, that's what I did a paper one time, a white paper on what business are you really in, And, you know, I did it at a seminar. I said, and everybody got said, well, we're in the business of helping people or leveling the playing field and all this. And I said, no, you're in the business of marketing. I mean, every successful business, I mean, that's, and I think Drucker said it, you know, marketing and innovation are the two biggest things that.
He said those drive business. Everything else is an expense. He also said, if you're not in the business of making whatever you do and however you do it obsolete, you can rest assured your competitors will do it to and for you, so you might as well do it yourself first. Meaning, if you're fortunate or unfortunate enough to have a winning, I can't talk, formula that's generating a lot of cases, a lot of prospects, lots of whatever, it's very easy to become complacent, arrogant, hubris, and not want to admit, well, that's the time to start finding anything different. I always, with clients, the moment something works is when we start figuring out what we're going to create to make it not work and make something better, because we know our competitors emulate, almost plagiarize, model, and worse, they innovate us. So you got to do it to yourself. What's your next question?
Yeah. So the next question is, and this is a deal that I think us and I think maybe Congress is actually a little bit ahead of us now, but you know, distrust, dubious people don't trust. I mean, we've been portrayed by the insurance industry as being ambulance chasers and crooks, and they've done a pretty good job of a lot better. They've outdone us. So what is the single biggest strategy from moving from distrust, dubious, and suspect to a seismic credibility? I mean, what's the single biggest action our members should do first? I mean, how can we – I mean, people have been indoctrinated, almost brainwashed, I would say, you know?
Well, there's two responses. I get it. There's two responses, or three that I'll give you, and it's a knee-jerk because I could probably go a lot deeper on this. Number one is sort of use the – there's the martial arts of – I can't remember what it is – the one where you use your enemy's power to your advantage. And self-effacing is great. I mean, I would start getting – maybe you start – you could actually have – it would be funny in a way if you almost became the advocate for a whole profession in your market and you started being interviewed. It's a great PR, you know. And I don't know if you'd say, you know, love your attorney week or something, but if you started really almost embracing full-on the problem and being the advocate for all your colleagues who are family members, who have kids, who have been members of church, you've had all these things, and you start doing, and you might even create some analysis and get media to pick it up and have it origin from you, so you get all the interviews. That's one thing. Second thing, Stephen M. R. Covey, I think that you'll find it on Franklin Covey. He's got a book called The Speed of Trust. He's got another book called Smart Trust, and he's done seminal work on what I call the last bastion of intangible leverage in business, and it's trust building. And they've analyzed that the more effective you are at trust, the average company that has high trust is like 300% more successful than the one that does not. And they've got something like 13 fundamental characteristics that are so simplistic, but they're worth re-reviewing every morning and every evening. And there's another concept that's a sort of an extrapolation, but one of my very dear friends is Fran Tarkenton. And I met him right after he'd had a very bad business reversal, and he used to be arrogant, and he used to be very, he was filled with himself, but he had a very bad public embarrassment. And he came back with a great humility, and he came back with a philosophy which I always loved. His philosophy was this. Anytime you're in anybody's life for any period of time, your job, your opportunity, your responsibility is to make them better off because you were in it. And better off is relative. Might be comforting. Might be, you know, just talking to them. Might be, you know, it's not ever, obviously, in your legal profession, you can't say what you can't say and can't promise what you can't promise. But comforting, acknowledging, and acknowledgement is very interesting. Acknowledgement, having people understand that, number one, you respect, you appreciate, you understand, you empathize, you grasp what it's like to be they, It's a very powerful and a very – you guys can come in. It's okay. It's a powerful way to connect very deeply. And trust building, I always make parenthetical asides. I mean, I'm not an attorney like you, but I would talk to whoever the marketplace is, or if I'm trying to win over the management, and I'd always make comments that show that I really grasp in words and perceptive acknowledgement and demonstrable indication that I really do grasp emotionally, transactionally, what it's like to be them in that job, in their life, whatever. I mean, and I think the more you can show people that you understand and appreciate what it's like to be them, it's a very powerful. And again, I mean, the way that you appreciate me most is not me telling you how great I am, or I have 7 kids, and I have mortgage, I got 3 mortgages, and I got all these other problems. What you're going to do to respect me as a human being is have me. You want to be respected, you respect. You want to be loved, love. You want to be understood, understand. It's pretty simple, actually. But it requires a listening that's transcendent of just your professional expression. You can be like, my wife and I are patrons of our hospital, and I'm probably a hypochondriac, and I travel a lot, and I manage a lot of things, and they're all creative and strategically dependent on me, and I get stressed a lot, and sometimes my heart rises, and I take a heart medication, and I always think I'm having a heart attack, or I'm having a blockage, and I always call my cardiologist, and he always, not happily, but accommodatingly gets me in that day for either, you know, I've had a bunch of echo stress tests, and I've had the same hour I've had them, made them give me whatever the thing is where they run the thing on, and I usually come back and they say you're a neurotic. And I'm actually happy. I'd rather be a neurotic than have blockage.
Absolutely.
But then they stop, and they're cold-hearted, and it's anticlimactic, and you leave frustrated. I don't mind being a neurotic. I just want to say, look, you're neurotic, but maybe this and maybe that. But they don't have enough time and enough empathy, so you can be the greatest damn prevailer in the courtroom. You can be the person that can get more judgments favorable and have $25 trillion to your name. But if you're bedside manner and engagement is a turnoff, or people don't feel felt, you're still going to lose, not all, of course, because your track record, and your, I mean, I was very arrogant, and I was much more acerbic when I was younger, and I still had a lot of business, but I have more when I'm empathic, I have more when I'm engaging, and it's actually more pleasurable for me. I don't know if that helps.
Yeah, absolutely. So I did have a question, because I've actually written this book, and I was thinking about licensing it, is the good that injury lawyers do. And then you could do that and get press releases and get on the air, because everybody's going to say injury lawyers are crooks. And then you could get in the deal and actually kind of what you were talking about before, kind of meet it head on instead of trying to hide behind, you know? I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah. I'm going to tell you something profoundly that impacted me. And again, I'm 64, and I've been doing this for 30-some years. In the 70s, there was a wonderful book written called Lawsuit. I'm trying to remember who wrote it. Would you remember, Ken, or can you look it up?
Okay.
He was one of the early, very successful advocates of personal injury law. I'm trying to remember who it was. I'll get it. It's Lawsuit. L-A-W, just one, or Lawsuit. I'll think who it is. But I'll tell you, it's important for you guys, and in case you should try to see if you can find the book. It's probably out of print, but I'll tell you why in just a minute. Who was it? Spicer. Stuart Spicer. Is that it?
Okay. Yeah, that sounds
is that right. It? Okay. My brain is old. And he had a whole chapter on the role of the entrepreneurial attorney. And he advocated that we have to, and we, I'm not trying to practice law without a license. I'm just trying to be, I'm just talking so we're all together. He'd say, we have to fund it. We have to believe in people. We have to. And he made this great case, and you might see if you can find it, because it's a very heartfelt articulation of being this. I mean, instead of being this cold and avaricious and uncaring, whatever, he depicted your colleagues, contemporaries, you each as probably the greatest advocates of really helping the you know, the community and really doing things and having and believing in them enough that you didn't ask to be paid, you paid. And it's very neatly articulated. I'm not saying plagiarize it, but I think you would all benefit if you could find that, and maybe you could make a deal where you could find it. I may be, I recall I was very profoundly impacted by how well it was articulated and what a great advocacy it was for the personal injury profession. But again, I haven't read it for years.
Okay, good stuff. So we got about 10 minutes left, and I'm going to take questions, but can you give, in case they want to, how people can get up with you? I mean, it's going to be hard to get up with you directly.
It's, you know, if you want to use me, I'm very expensive, so, but I'm delighted if you want to use me. But if you just want to have the education of a lifetime, I don't sell much anymore. We have about 500 hours of really cool stuff, videos, audios, you know, self-assessments, all kinds of things on preeminence demonstrations of how it applies to entrepreneurs. It's all up on my website, abraham.com/profit resources. Okay.
Okay. So is it any questions? We got 8 minutes tops. Any questions?
None?
No, they never ask questions.
Oh, you should ask questions. What an opportunity.
Yeah. I mean,
well, let me ask you a question. Why don't you do this? Ask a different question and ask for perspective. And I'm not looking for my ego to be engaged. You got a question?
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, this is Howard Spava. Someone walked in my office. I couldn't hear. What was the book that you were talking about?
Lawsuit,
and it was written by somebody who I think was very prominent in the 70s, Stuart Spicer.
I've read a couple of books like that, and I'm trying to remember if this is
wonderful article. Yeah, it's long ago, but it's like an evergreen articulation. I think you could borrow freely some of the perspective. So if nobody has questions other than that, let me ask you to ask them a question, okay?
Okay.
And I've got thick skin. So what one distinction, what one shift in perspective perhaps did they gain from this few minutes of listening to me that might be useful? And then they can say, you're full of hot air and you won't offend me because a lot of people have said that to me.
Okay.
I'm just trying to see if we made an impact.
Yeah, so anybody out there, what's the biggest thing you got out of this today?
If anything.
Yeah, if anything. Anybody? Such a quiet crowd.
This is Gary Solomon. How are you?
All right, how are you today, Gary? Hey, Gary.
I think I need another 1980 testimonials on my...
you can never have enough.
My question is, where do you see this trending as far as reaching people, communicating people 5 years? We hear a lot about social media. We hear a lot about the web, about television, and right now everything seems to be quite dysfunctional. But as you indicated, change is important to re-innovate. Where do you think we're going to be for reaching the masses in 5 years from now?
Truthfully, it is going to be very heavily social, but it's very, I mean, I'm involved in some confidential stuff with a private equity firm that's rolling up advertising service, online advertising service and platform companies, and it's now becoming really, it's content information on demand, where they want, when they want it, and you're going to, I mean, you can disacknowledge, because like direct mail still works sort of. You know, if you got enough of a powerful premise, I'm sure to some degree TV or radio still works. Referral generation will always work, but peer confirmation online is going to always be the best because people are going to look you up one way or the other. You're going to look me up. You probably looked me up as you were talking or before you came on this. That's going to be more and more and more, not just the credibility, but the things that you do and the we use the word content, although I don't like it. It's a little too generic and too nondescript. But it's very important, and I think you need, if you're successful at all, reinvest in understanding it. But don't just accept whoever wants to charge you a couple $1,000s a month to be your social person. invest the same time you would on a case and learn, you know, interview 20 different people, ask them what's going on, read, get subscriptions, learn about it, because it's going to more and more define how you are seen. And again, I'm not trying to be, it's not my skill set, but I'm telling you, it's going to be more and more, it's going to be asymmetric, like the hockey stick that venture capitalists look for in growth. It's going to be that relevant in choosing you over your competitor.
Yeah, I agree. I think people go to the website. In fact, I had this lady sitting outside today. There's a law office beside me, and she was taking a smoke break. Of course, I won't smoke it, but she had some things on her feet, like boots. And I said, "Yeah, you got doing a deposition or something?" She said, "Yeah." She says, "I said, well, you got a great lawyer." And she says, "Oh, I know I do." She says, "I talked to him. I saw him on a call-in show, and then I went to the web and looked him up, and then I also called the state bar to make sure." So, I mean, this lady looked like she probably had a eighth grade education, was missing one.
But
two.
They all know to do it now.
They're 60 years old. I mean, 60, 65 years old, and she did all that before she hired her lawyer.
Yeah, the consumer. That speaks
volumes. I mean, you know, I mean, she wasn't highly educated. I mean, I can tell you what the clothes and her the way she talked and held herself together. I mean, she's nice, but I'm just saying. And I was nice to her, I said, "Well, why do you know you got one?" And I just started talking to her and asking her more because, as you say, Jay, if you can get in there and figure out what their big deal, and I asked her some other questions. I won't take up your time, but the deal is, I think we need to be doing this more with our clients, you know, sometime along the road, so you can figure out what it
you're,
is.
You're absolutely right. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot. I mean, I mean, there's adages, and I can't cite them well, but you're not gonna stop change. So you either make it it's either your enemy or ally. You either harness it, or it overwhelms and topples you. So you might as well embrace it and maximize and optimize and harness it. Anyhow, I hope this has added value. I'm honored and privileged to have the forum to anybody who listened to me. So I hope I haunt you with interesting thoughts, and thank you, Ken, for the privilege.
Thank you, Jay. I appreciate it so much. I'll see you next month.
Okay, bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.